The French Revolution. This was a violent upheaval that destroyed the monarchy in France after having ruled the nation basically since its inception as the Kingdom of the Franks in 481. I'll mostly focus on the causes of the French Revolution, but I'm not going to talk much about the terror that came after. Going too far into the terror gets into kind of a hornet's nest of complicated power struggles that would just take me a long time to unpack, and we just don't have time in this episode. But I will dig into some juicy bits of the revolution, and it will lead us on a direct path to understanding electricity with Alessandro Volta.
Welcome to Meridians.
Welcome to Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble, and thanks for listening. Got a great episode here, lots to talk about, so we're just going to dig right into it. So France, in 1715 AD, King Louis XV ascended to the throne after his great-grandfather, King Louis XIV, died. He had kind of big shoes to fill. Louis XIV was the longest verifiable reigning monarch ever, like anywhere. His reign lasted for 72 years and 110 days. He would see France become the most powerful country in Europe and effectively turn France into an absolute monarchy. The king ruled supreme. Before he died, he did leave the nation with a certain amount of debt, which would be left to his successor to handle. That's how the stage is set for King Louis XV, who would try to extend his great-grandfather's reign and keep France a superpower among nations. Certainly, this means butting heads with Great Britain. So King Louis XV inherited this rule, and he was not the ruler that his great-grandfather was. He was corrupt and would often embarrass the monarchy in his actions. He relied on mistresses for political influence, which was seen as a sign of weakness. And these actions would erode the public trust in the monarchy. It seemed like everything this guy did would erode the public trust in the monarchy. The Seven Years' War, which was fought between 1756 and 1763, was a major conflict that was mostly fought between British and French forces with all sorts of proxies in between. But France lost most of its colonial territories to Great Britain as a result of this war, which put France in a large amount of debt. Though the war really cost both sides a great deal of money, at least the British had something to show for it. And remember, the country had a great deal of debt when Louis's reign began, and he just kept making it worse. Not that Great Britain didn't play a large part themselves in making it worse. So now we're in the 1760s, after the Seven Years' War. Economically, the people of France had other problems. Their taxation system, it was horrible. Taxes were unevenly distributed, and local municipalities would tax at different rates. It created a mess. The king would seem to tax more and more to pay for the war and also for his lavish lifestyle, while the public was abused and increasingly finding themselves in worse and worse shape. And by uneven distribution of taxes, there was an important concept with France at the time. There was the system known as the Three Estates. So you had the clergy in the First Estate, nobility in the Second Estate, and then the Third Estate, which was everyone else, the peasants and the plebs. And this also included the bourgeoisie group, the kind of merchant class. Well, in 1749, there was this 5% income tax that was supposed to apply to everyone across the board. It was known as the first vingtieme. Clergy, nobility, everyone. It was supposed to be like a flat tax. But King Louis XV, being the weak baby king that he was handing out tax exemptions left and right within the First and Second Estates. So when the Seven-Year War broke out, and the king hadn't been collecting taxes from the richest people in the country, he pushed the country further down into debt, of course. So what was his solution? Levy another tax to help pay for the war. Then after the war, France was still in debt, of course, so more taxes were levied. Yet many of these exemptions remained in place for the highly influential king's friends. And while the country's bill is getting worse and worse, what kind of lifestyle is King Louis XV living? He's living a lavish lifestyle with fine clothes, having multiple mistresses, and having large lavish parties among the elite classes in France. They were drinking, partying, and screwing around, and he just doesn't strike me as a serious person at all. He lives in this lavish palace known as Versailles, which is filled with all this decadent artwork, the finest of everything, the peak of decadence for its time. And the word decadence seems to describe this little era before the revolution perfectly. The word decadence even comes from the Latin verb decadere, meaning to fall or to sink. How perfect is that? So then, King Louis XV got smallpox and died in 1774. So all that partying, and he doesn't even have to deal with the repercussions. He just dies. The country then falls to the hands of King Louis XVI, his grandson. Now, this would kind of be like King Louis the Fuck Up Part 2. But at least King Louis XVI made some attempt at ruling, though he kind of sucked at it. He would have rather spent time on his hobby, which was making keys. He even apparently had a blacksmith who would assist him in his key making at the palace, which he apparently even did right up until, well, we'll get to that. But now, besides all this, he probably was better than his grandpa, at least, who seemed to have just partied, spent money, and treated the nation of France like his personal piggy bank. But Louis XVI took power when he was only 19 or 20 years old. So he did have one feather in his cap, though. One feather in his leadership, Louis XVI. He supported the American War of Independence financially and through supplies. This was pretty early on in his reign, too. 1774, you know, the revolution was only a few years later. And France would actually have 12,000 soldiers assisting in the war. In fact, I didn't know this, but the Battle of Yorktown apparently had more French soldiers than American ones. Additionally, France sent significant naval forces, about 22,000 French naval personnel aboard 63 different warships participated in the war effort. This was clearly as much a proxy war as it was a revolutionary war. That war was, of course, successful for the French and the American revolutionaries, and King Louis got to stick it to Great Britain. However, it would put France in even more debt, like a lot more debt. And I kind of imagine he probably regretted this much later. It's kind of ironic that he would support a violent revolution, considering what would soon happen to him. Louis XVI kind of tripped and fell through his leadership and managed to be fairly responsible for, well, two democratic revolutions. So good for him, I guess. So with all this turmoil, there was actually a population boom happening in France. France went from about 20 million at the beginning of the 18th century to about 28 million by the 1780s. So the country's population grew by about a third. That's crazy. And this led to this wild demand for food and consumer goods. So not only is the country in massive debt, but now he's having problems feeding people. And 80% of the population was rural and facing poverty. To make matters worse, these taxes basically made them into indentured servants with all these financial obligations. Imagine having to scrape by just to get enough to eat, and I know a lot of folks don't have to imagine that, but then on top of that, you've got this giant unpayable tax burden on yourself. All the while, you see carriages roll by with aristocrats, clergy, and noble elites. Then your kids maybe hanging out the windows with crumbs on their faces, fat and happy as can be. Meanwhile, your kids are barely eating well at all, and you're trapped in the system. It might as well be a prison. These people were probably marinating in a stew of anger and frustration, just waiting for something to happen. So this is where it's weird, though, because while the peasants of the Third Estates are having a really bad life, there's this growing merchant class, the bourgeoisie. Based on what I've said so far, you'd expect that this economy in France was in tatters, but it really wasn't. That's what is really messed up about all this. France had a large GDP, reportedly three times that of Britain by 1789. Since 1717, foreign trade in France had increased 500%. And with that, business did a grow. So this bourgeoisie merchant class within their third estate actually grew to nearly 2 million people. Now, not all of the bourgeoisie were wealthy. This included some shopkeepers and artisans too. And they were getting levied all these taxes as well. They aren't exempt. And the only way they can get any kind of political representation is to like bang their way into the French court, which few obviously could do. Remember, this is an absolute monarchy. What the king says goes, and you don't get a vote, you don't get representation. But this class, this bourgeoisie, saw their economic power growing. They had money, and they were on the outside of the king's court, wondering what life could be like if changes had been made. New ideas about freedom and liberty were starting to flourish. Many of these bourgeoisie were well-educated people. They started to engage with the Enlightenment ideas. They were well aware of the American Revolution and the concept of liberty was growing all across Europe. Hell, these merchants and poor people in France were the ones who really financed the American Revolution, if you think about it. Through borrowed money, sure, but the money had to come from somewhere. It's coming off of the backs of the poor people. There was also the idea of the separation of powers, and the bourgeoisie was attracted to rational ideas like this, and many became critical of religion as well, especially the concept of secularism, whereby your morality isn't dictated by religious doctrine. And the French monarchy was closely linked to the Catholic Church. In fact, the Catholic Church owned about 10% of the land in France at the time. And remember, the first estate is the clergy, and they aren't paying any taxes. Jesus does not pay taxes, man. So all this would put the middle-class, well-educated group of merchants in the same side as the peasants, who are very angry. And, you know, who do you think these peasants work for? They were largely employed by these bourgeoisie, and the bourgeoisie wanted more power and representation in government. The peasants probably just wanted a way out of these crazy tax burdens and wanted a decent life for their family. They just want to be able to feed their family. That's the vibe building throughout Louis XVI's reign, while he's basically carrying on like an idiot, making keys and having parties, just like Grandpa did. So now's a good time to talk about King Louis XVI's wife, Marie Antoinette, the Queen of France. I was going to do a short timeline of her like early life, but here's the cliff notes because it's all royal courts and power struggles and political marriages and all that hubbub. The important thing is that she was a kind of a spoiled Australian Habsburg who married into the French Bourbon family and spent a bunch of money while others were struggling. She was a year and 9 months younger than her husband, so they were both young when they became king and queen. So we're talking like she was 17, 18, he was 19 or 20. And they were practically teenagers when they took control of a country, a huge country that was not doing well. Today, no large business in their right mind would hand over the leadership to their grandkids just out of high school. I have a tough time sympathizing with the king, but Antoinette's life is kind of complicated. She was 14 when she got married. Her whole life was centered around etiquette and being a royal in France, a country completely foreign to her. Before Louis XV croaked in the early years of their marriage, they would be known as the Dauphin and Dauphine of France, basically like prince and princess. Storybook shit, you know, like she was doing the Disney princess dress-up stuff for real. She was actually well-liked at first. She was a sign of change. Both her and King Louis XVI when they came to power. They're these young new faces. Surely they're going to have some better ideas than Grandpa did. And this foreign girl and her young new king, you know, maybe they could change France for the better. It was an enlightened time after all. Maybe this young couple could save them. But it really didn't take long for the public's mood to sour against her. And him, really. In 1775, 1 year into their reign, bread and flour supplies were strained, and prices began to skyrocket. There were over 300 riots across France from April to May of that year. The king and queen, being the image of change for France, would start to sour very quickly in the public's mind, and they would start to be seen as the representatives of France's problem. So that didn't take long, just a couple of years. And amidst all this chaos is an interesting little side story I wanted to cover. It's kind of a juicy little story. It is the diamond necklace fiasco, which Antoinette really doesn't have any guilt per se, or she barely has a role in it, yet it's kind of all about her. But it's a significant story in regards to Marie Antoinette because it would destroy what was left of her reputation in the public's eye only 4 years before the French Revolution took place. So we have to go back in time for this. In 1772, King Louis XV, so Grandpa Fuckface, the guy that was just fucking off all the time, not doing anything for France, he decided to make a special gift for one of his mistresses, Madame du Barry. It was a very ornate diamond necklace. Today it would cost $17.5 million, you know, so just a nice little trinket. It's this very ornate thing with all these, it's kind of an ugly necklace if you ask me, but I don't know, I'm not that into jewelry or anything, but you can see pictures of what it looked like or online. I think there's like a reproduction of it. But so the jewelers, they took years to complete this necklace, and it just took a considerable amount of time to gather the diamonds needed to get the right sizes for the right fit. In the meantime, well, King Louis, he died of smallpox, so it's kind of a tough break for these jewelers. King Louis XVI, the grandson and successor to the throne, didn't much care for his grandfather's mistress, Madame du Barry, and banished her from the court. The jewelers then hoped that the new Queen of France, Marie Antoinette, might purchase the necklace. Her husband, King Louis XVI, offered it to her, but she refused, stating that they had more need for ships than for necklaces. Apparently she said that, which sounds a little pragmatic. To me, I would say that's a little bit of a point for Marie Antoinette there. But it's also believed that Antoinette just didn't like Madame du Barry, and that's why she refused the necklace. Du Barry was seen as sort of an interloper at court, like she had no place there. Anything related to her probably just repulsed the queen. The jewelers would try to sell it to the queen again later after her son was born. I don't know why they thought that. Maybe thinking she'd get confused because she just had a kid. Like, she still doesn't want it. So she refused them again. So this necklace doesn't have a buyer. It kind of sits idle for a while waiting for someone rich enough to come forward. And we'll get back to the necklace. Okay. Meanwhile, this confidence huckster, flim flam lady, whatever you want to call her, shows up on the scene. She called herself Jeanne de Valois-Saint-Remy, but she was also known as Jeanne Lamotte. So I'm just going to refer to her as Lamotte to keep things simple, but just know she went by a couple different names. She was kind of a social climber of sorts, having been a descendant of an out-of-wedlock son of Henry II of France. She married an officer of the French army and lived off of a small pension granted by the king. But she wanted to gain wealth. She wanted power, even maybe a royal patronage. So she started devising a scheme. In 1785, Lamotte became the mistress of Cardinal de Rohan. So he's a, you know, real church-like behavior on behalf of a cardinal. I always think of like a cardinal or priest as being like celibate, especially the higher up, but apparently not this cardinal. Now this cardinal, he had some history with Marie Antoinette. He was actually an ambassador to Vienna for France for a time. Clearly he did a bang up job of that. He actually managed to arouse both the dislikes of Marie Antoinette and her mother, So Antoinette really didn't care for him because he had referred to her mother in an unfavorable way in a letter, and she found out about it. Marie Antoinette's mother is Maria Theresa, and like the Wu-Tang Clan, she ain't nothing to fuck with. She united the Habsburg family, made Austria very wealthy, and she probably deserves a large segment for her someday on a different podcast. But just for context, know that this Cardinal Rohan managed to piss off two very powerful women in two different kingdoms. The word idiot comes to mind when I think of this guy. The Cardinal was now desperate to regain the Queen's favor and maybe become one of the King's ministers. Oh yeah, that feels real likely, buddy. So Lamotte, his mistress, convinces Rohan that she's good friends with the Queen and corresponded with her. With the help of Reto de Villette, she would forge letters and show them to Rohan, looking like they were from the Queen. And this began a fake correspondence where Rohan thought he was actually exchanging letters with Marie Antoinette. But the letters were actually written by Lamotte's co-conspirator and lover, Villette. And they were so convincing that they had Rohan believing that the Queen was in love with him. Lamotte even arranged a fake secret meeting between the Queen and Rohan. Rohan thought that he'd met with the Queen, but it was really a prostitute Lamotte had hired to pose as the Queen. Yeah, he was really an idiot. And Rohan nearly completely fooled now. Lamotte started borrowing large sums of money from him, stating that it was for the Queen's charitable work. Lamotte was hoping this money could propel her into respectable society. She wanted that power, money, and status, baby. Meanwhile, Lamotte is openly projecting that she is friends with the Queen, so much that the public at large starts to believe her. So back to those jewelers who were left with a very expensive necklace and no buyer. They heard about Lamotte, and they thought, hey, this lady's good friends with the Queen. Why don't we see if we can get her to help us sell it? These jewelers, they just sound so desperate, don't they? It shows how expensive the necklace was. These jewelers' only hope of selling it seemed to be the one person they bothered asking, the Queen. They just wouldn't quit, it seems. But what else are they going to do? So Lamotte eventually agrees to these jewelers to help facilitate the sale. But Lamotte instead tried to fold this into her little scheme with the Cardinal Rohan. She again starts sending Rohan correspondence as if it's from the Queen. She convinces Rohan that, as the Queen, and in such a difficult financial time, she can't be seen buying such an expensive necklace. Again, in reality, the Queen has no idea this is happening. This is all just Lamotte. She's pulling all the strings with this guy. Now, this letter asking Rohan to purchase the necklace was important because it'd come up later. Lamotte didn't properly sign the Queen's signature the way a royal would typically sign. The French royals only signed with their given name, but Lamotte, with the help of Villette, her accomplice, forged Marie Antoinette of France as the signature, where it should have had her maiden name from Austria. So Rohan, fully believing that the Queen wants him to buy this necklace, manages to put up the money and agrees to pay in installments. He claimed to the jewelers that the Queen had given him authorization and showed the letter that the Queen had given the authorization for. What's stupid about this is that Lamotte, posing as the Queen, specifically told him she didn't want to be seen buying this. So he's kind of defeating the purpose here by telling the jewelers who it's for. He's kind of delusional, right? And he's an idiot. He was in his early 50s at the time, and the Queen was a lot, I think she was 20 years younger, about 20 years younger. So how on earth could she think she was, why would he think she was just so into him? It's just bizarre. So Rohan, being the genius that he is, gets the necklace and gives it to Lamotte to give to the Queen. And then Lamotte promptly picks it apart and sells the gems on the black market, just like that. So Lamotte probably thought she got swindled. She just swindled this guy really well. I mean, she did, right? But then the blowback came. When it was actually time to start paying for the necklace, Lamotte would reference the note from the Queen herself. This was not good enough for the jewelers, though. So then they contacted the actual queen themselves. Oh, shit. So the queen, of course, doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about. She doesn't know who Lamotte is. She knows who Rohan is, sure, but she's not in contact with him, and she certainly isn't in love with him. So the timing of this is just really bad for everybody involved. Cardinal Rohan was that day was about to officiate the Feast of the Assumption of Mary, which is this big religious celebration. And while he's waiting for the king and queen to show up, he gets arrested and taken before the king and queen and their little minions to explain himself. He realizes pretty quickly that he's been duped and produces a letter with the queen's signature. But, you know, it's the wrong signature, and they see that it was incorrectly signed. They argued he should have known better, having understood royal etiquette his entire life. Also, who the fuck did this guy think he was, right? Like, that had to be really awkward for him. Like, you thought, what? The queen was in love with you? What? So they throw his ass in prison in the Bastille. And Lamotte is arrested 3 days later, but she had time to destroy some evidence. So this resulted in a long, drawn-out trial for Rohan and Lamotte. And this ordeal enraged the Pope of the Catholic Church. As it turns out, he wasn't happy about his cardinal being put in prison. Lucky for Rohan, he was eventually acquitted of all wrongdoing. Lamotte, though, oh no, she did not get off easy. She was whipped, and then she was branded with a V, which stood for thief, and then thrown into a prison for prostitutes. So Rohan and the Queen ended up being considered blameless by the Paris Parliament. Right? So what's the big deal, right? But the public, being the public, watched this trial, I'd say very closely, but clearly they weren't watching that closely. Their trust in institutions had been eroding for years, though, and many persisted in believing that the Queen used Lamotte as an instrument to satisfy her hatred for Cardinal Rohan. And she wasn't fond of this guy in the first place, so Lamotte had been so convincing that she was friends with the Queen that the public believed her over the Queen. Overall, the evidence was to the contrary, but the public perception of the Queen had already been tarnished. The whole scandal made it irreversibly worse. You know, it's kind of that thing where nobody reads the correction in the newspaper 3 days later. So it's like this perception of her is just kind of lit on fire by this whole affair. And this is, remember, 4 years before the French Revolution would take place. And while we're talking about her, if you're wondering about Marie Antoinette and thinking, when did she say, let them eat cake? Well, she didn't. She never said that. It was attributed to her in a journal in 1843, 50 years after the French Revolution. There's no contemporary mentions. There's actually a mention, apparently, of some vague princess that came before, but it was like not specifically about her, and it didn't even make sense because she would have been a little girl at the time, so not even in France. It doesn't make any sense. Historians also say that this was out of character for her and has no basis in fact. It's one of those dumb things in history that keeps getting passed down because it, you know, it sounds spicy or whatever. Okay, so back to the general problems in France at the time. The financial crisis was getting even worse as the government was being run just so poorly that it went bankrupt. So an Estates General was convened on May 5th, 1789, to come up with solutions. And this was a huge deal. They hadn't convened the Estates General since 1614, so over 150 years earlier. So it was a massive event for France and would mark a turning point, as we'll see. So this is a large assembly that would include members of the French community across all of the three French estates. Remember, there's the first estates, the clergy, the second estates, nobility, and then the peasant class with the bourgeoisie and all those folks. So it's easy to know who to expect to be invited from the first two estates, clergy and nobility. So basically the leadership of the clergy and nobility are going to be the ones represented there. But the third estate was 98% of the French population. So who was invited from that class? Well, it was only to even qualify, you had to be a male taxpayer over the age of 25 to be eligible. And then each district would actually elect who would go to represent their district. But they had to pay their own way to the convention. So you had to be sort of wealthy, like a wealthy merchant, to even be considered from the Third Estate. So as a result, the majority of the Third Estate delegation were members of the bourgeoisie. And the Third Estate also got double representation at the convention. Well, that's a relief. You know, 98% of the population had 25% of the representation, and only the wealthiest of that Third Estate. So more sign that the king and the nobility are simply out of touch with this growing Enlightenment thinking. So the Third Estate was allotted 578 deputies to attend this convention. Great. So now we have this big convention. We can sort out all our differences and vive la France. Let's go. Well, the assembly started and they couldn't even agree on how to vote. They couldn't decide on how to vote at the gathering. I feel like that's something you might want to, like, I don't know, just decide that ahead of time. But I don't know. Maybe they couldn't. Whatever. So the Third Estate, they demanded that voting be done by head count rather than the estate, which would give them a significant advantage due to their larger numbers. Well, yeah, why else did they come all that way if not, why get double representation if you're not going to actually use those representatives? It's kind of, who's the more, why would you not do it by head count? So this really shows just how out of touch the leadership in France was. They thought they could just convene this large assembly to come up with solutions and still be able to dictate how every little rule of the assembly would go. These are not serious people, the leadership of France. They're just ridiculous. So this would be the first real direct challenge to the monarchy. This is when it would happen. The Third Estate simply walked away from the assembly and formed their own assembly, which they called the National Assembly. This move made the monarchy look weak. It had to take some courage for the Third Estate to do it, but, I mean, what a move. That had to be exhilarating, kind of, fuck 'em, we're doing our own assembly. That's great. So they even had some members of the clergy and nobility join in on this National Assembly. The winds were certainly shifting, and that's a huge sign that some people understood what was going on. And maybe some of these clergy and nobility were like, enough with this shit. This king is an idiot. And, you know, a lot of them had probably lived through the previous king and they were just done with it. So then the king ended their estates general because nobody wanted to play by his idiotic rules anymore. And the National Assembly basically conducted itself without the king's oversight. And this National Assembly would then form a new government, and they're doing this like right under the king's nose. Like it's right there. He's in Paris. So they'd form a new government. It would effectively become France's first revolutionary government. They passed the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, which stated, "Men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Social distinctions may be based only on considerations of the common good. The aim of every political association is the preservation of the natural and imprescriptible rights of man. These rights are liberty, property, safety, and resistance to oppression." They voted to abolish the feudal system, and they also nationalized church property. Ouch. Goodbye to your 10% of France's land, Catholic Church. Many, many reforms were made. They also vowed not to end the assembly until France had a new constitution. And this pissed the king off. Something awful. So what does he do? Does he round them all up and shoot the leaders? Hang them in the public square? What's he do? He closed their meeting place. That'll show them. For the guy who probably secured the United States freedom from Great Britain, he was kind of a dipshit, wasn't he? I mean, jeez. The king did start to gather troops in Paris, though. Eventually, the National Assembly would request that, could please remove these troops? I like that they just asked. Hey, we don't really appreciate you, putting troops here. So the king basically told them to fuck off, that he was in charge. And oh yeah, at this point this is the point in the movie where Bane leans in and says, "Do you feel in charge?" I'm sorry. That's a Dark Knight Rises reference if you're not familiar. It came to my head when this king doesn't realize that he's lost control already. There were food shortages. The National Assembly was getting restless, and they had to act. On July 14th, 1789, members of the National Assembly and the Third Estate stormed the Bastille in Paris. And the Bastille, I briefly mentioned that it was a prison where the cardinal had been sent for a while. Well, it was also a military fortress. It was a vital fortress for France, originally designed to protect it from attacks by England. Very important landmark for France. You know, if you want to get real touristy, you can go over to France and it won't be there. I mean, there's a little bit left, but why? What happened to it? Because the French Revolution. The revolutionaries were able to overwhelm the guards and take control of the Bastille. And to this day, Bastille Day is celebrated on July 14th in France, known as Le Quatre or like Les Quatre Sœurs Juliette. All right, anyway, damn it. I want to celebrate with them, though. Once I figure out how to pronounce it correctly, that was a pretty brave move to storm the Bastille. I'm sure several of them died. You know, they weren't going to France, or they weren't going to Paris to start a war. They were trying to fix the government's problems, but they ended up starting a war, a revolutionary war. So then the revolutionaries would eventually win control of the government, and King Louis XVI would be executed. And this is 4 years later. So it was a slow, they were being methodical and organized to some degree. It couldn't just be, it was a little chaotic around the time, but they had to figure out how to take control of everything. And there was a struggle. There was a fight. There was a war, a battle. And I'm kind of skipping over that. I know I can't really go into the details of the war of the French Revolution, but pretty rough. I'll just say that. So Marie Antoinette, she's executed 9 months later on October 16th. And I do feel kind of bad for her. She didn't choose France. It was an arranged marriage. The government was in shambles when she was arranged to be married to the king, well, the prince at the time. She actually lost 3 of her 4 kids. One died in a French prison at 10 years old. Man, history is just a rough place. Antoinette's daughter, her firstborn, Maria Theresa, named after Antoinette's grandmother or mother, of course. She actually survived and would be like traded in a prison swap years later, and she'd live into her 70s. So that's kind of cool. But this leads us to our next tragic figure who would actually present. He was there for all of this insanity, Antoine Lavoisier. Now I'm going to cover his story, and we'll also get a little bit more of an insight into the revolution as well. Antoine Lavoisier lived from 1743 to 1794. He lived in Paris, France, and if you're paying attention, you might wonder, why did he die in 1794? Well, we'll get to that. So he was born into a wealthy family of nobility in Paris in 1743, so during Louis XV's rule. So what do we care about Antoine Lavoisier? Who is he? Well, he's the father of modern chemistry. Kind of a big deal. As you learn about him, I would challenge you to compare him more with the king and the nobility and these types of people who really did nothing for society other than be a decadent waste. This guy has some skeletons in his closet, as we'll see, though he's a central figure in this whole concept we have today. These hidden laborers. And he's not one of them. He's more the result of that labor, the fruit of the labor, if you will. So when Lavoisier was 5 years old, he inherited a large fortune after the death of his mother. He then went to school and gained a massive interest in science, chemistry, botany, astronomy, and mathematics. And he was tutored by Abbé Nicolas Louis de la Calais, who was a distinguished mathematician and astronomer at the time. He would spark an interest in Lavoisier for astronomy that stuck with him his entire life. And Lavoisier would go on to enter the School of Law and was even admitted to the bar, though he never really actually practiced law. It's kind of interesting. He had a legal degree, but didn't practice law. Instead, he would continue to study science, what he really cared about. He would attend lectures in the natural sciences and would eventually gain a keen interest in chemistry. His largest influence, which led him to chemistry, was the prominent French scholar Étienne Bonnot de Condillac. He started publishing papers on chemicals and eventually began reading his papers to the French Academy of Sciences, which was France's most elite scientific society. By 1768, Lavoisier would be given a provincial appointment to the Academy of Sciences. And he seems like a genuinely decent person for the world he was born into. He really seemed to care about his country and its people, despite being from the wealthy, privileged, noble class. He submitted a paper to improve street lighting in 1765, and then in 1768, he focused on a new project to design an aqueduct. He wanted to bring the water from the River Yvette into Paris so that the citizens could have clean drinking water. He was always thinking of things like this. This project never started, but it did lead Lavoisier to want to try to solve the problem of purifying water from the Seine. This would lead to a more general interest in public sanitation. He also conducted studies about air quality and investigated the hygiene in prisons. Just trying to improve society, you know? He's not trying to be some social climber like Lamotte, not trying to just buy nice dresses and have everyone look at me and say, oh, pretty. He seems fairly genuine, but there's a dark side to him, as we'll very soon learn. But first, let's talk about why he's the father of modern chemistry. For one, he discovered that oxygen plays a crucial role in combustion, as well as respiration. This discovery alone laid the foundation for a modern understanding of chemical reactions. At the time, the leading theory was that this phlogiston theory. This theory was that there was a fire-like element called phlogiston, and it was believed that this element was contained within combustible substances. So anything that burned, they thought, had this phlogiston in it. So during this time, he would present something very interesting to the Academy of Sciences. He demonstrated that when water was heated in a vessel, it wasn't converted to earth, as it was thought at the time. He did this quantitative experiment where he showed that the water must have evaporated entirely from the test vessel. So you could tell that it weighed differently. And this would lead to the law of conservation of mass, which is yet another big milestone in science credited to him. He also established a quantitative approach to science, created classification methods, and even played a role in developing the metric system. The French Academy of Sciences, of which he was a part, actually created the metric system. They actually created it during a really odd time as well. They created it during the Reign of Terror. You know, I was talking about the terror at the very beginning of the show. And that's with Lavoisier. He's going to become very intimately familiar with the terror, but it's kind of wild that they created such an important system that's still used today amidst one of the craziest times in France's history. Though I suppose France has had more than their fair share of crazy times. Lavoisier certainly spent a lot of time thinking about progressive ideas, too. He had a really forward-thinking vision for their public education system. He imagined it as having roots in scientific sociability. If their government had been structured differently under different circumstances, he seems like the type of guy who could have really done a lot more good in the world than he actually was able to do. Strangely enough, Lavoisier made most of his money from investing in the General Farm. And no, it wasn't an actual farm. France had outsourced their tax collection to a third-party group, and it was known as the Farm Ferme Générale. And it was a group of 40 tax farmers that collected tax duties on behalf of the king. Kind of weird. So you could invest money in a group of people that was guaranteed to make money. I mean, it's kind of a hell of a deal for the nobility, who were, of course, the primary investors. And Lavoisier was actually a really big investor in this tax collection scheme. Calling him an investor is how they put it, but it seems to have been more involved. He was like in the administration and the function of this tax collection organization too. So he's such a good guy. You know, he's got all these social ideas, but then he's involved with these people who are, I mean, they're kind of the source of the problems we've been talking about all day. I mean, the root problem is the king, but the tax collectors certainly played their part, and Lavoisier is one of them. So what gives, man? It was certainly not out of character for a person of his noble birth, but that is how he would finance his scientific study. And he tried to find ways to, you know, he's trying to use his time well to feed people better. You know, maybe he's kind of a worthy investment. I don't know. Even if it was kind of a forced investment on behalf of everyone who paid taxes, I just don't know about that. I think that my problem with Lavoisier, you know, it's just that. It's not him personally. It's just this concept that there's this class-based society that affords him the he gets the liberty to try and do good, at least doing good in the way that he sees it. But the public at large has no say in his actions, which they are clearly financing. And he's got no obligations to these people either. He could just stop at any point. So he's kind of a complicated guy, if you ask me. After all, he was firmly in the camp of the enlightened thinkers, too. So what was he doing? He was probably well aware of this contradiction. He could probably see the rising problems, but had never imagined. I think that's the thing, is he never imagined a revolution would happen in his lifetime. And so he thought, well, I can't change that. I guess I'm just going to live inside of the system. Man, how many times have you heard that before? So Lavoisier actually commissioned the building of a wall around Paris. This is about taxes, so that customs duties could be collected from these from anyone transporting goods into and out of the city. So it was kind of a tax duty. You go in and you go out, you got to pay some tax. And this would not be looked at very popularly. This would be scrutinized later and not good for Lavoisier. So I'm keeping score here. Lavoisier, he is definitely in the off with their heads group right now. He's right there, you know. So then Lavoisier, he married a 13-year-old girl, the daughter of the Ferme Générale, a leader of the Ferme Générale, and he was 28 at the time. I mention her, though, because she would help Lavoisier later in his scientific career. She helped him out a lot. As for her being 13, it was an arranged marriage. I mean, Marie Antoinette was only 14 when she was married, but of course he was about 15, 16, so it was less icky, but it's different times, but I hate always just saying different times. It's still icky. It's icky from my perspective. So now for a few years, he's actually spent most of his time with the official Ferme Générale business. You know, he's got to get that paper, you know, because I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Okay, so to be fair, he tried to introduce some reforms to the monetary and tax system to help the peasant class. Tried is the key word there. If he had succeeded, maybe this story would be a completely different thing. But another thing he did relating to taxes was that Lavoisier would get obsessed with things. Like, he got obsessed with the way tobacco was sold. The Ferme Générale actually held a monopoly on the production, import, and sale of tobacco in France. It's just weird stuff like this. It's just so hard to fathom this concept that, oh yeah, they're in charge of that thing. They're the only ones that get to say what that thing is, like tobacco. it just seems bonkers from my like 21st century indoctrinated capitalist mindset. It's just weird to me. But he mastered this whole system so that black market tobacco, it would be hard to sell. And he ended up making an enemy of all the tobacco retailers as a result. But it was a very successful tax collection purposes. The whole thing he did too, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, but like all he did was he added water to the tobacco before it was sold and transported for two reasons. It was to make the tobacco fresher. So yeah, that's good. But for the second reason, it made the tobacco weigh more, and more weight made his associates more money. So woohoo, right? But that would come back to bite him in the ass. This guy just does not seem like he sees the forest from the trees. He's just obsessive about study and aloof about reality. That's kind of how I see this guy. This tobacco thing would be a black mark, and they would not forget it. But then in this weird way, Lavoisier whiplashes back to doing something good. He urged the establishment of a Royal Commission on Agriculture. He would end up spending large sums of his own money to find ways to improve agricultural yields. He conducted a 10-year study on this, which concluded in 1788, so a year before the revolution. And his findings were that there were some possible changes that farmers could make, but they were so burdened by the tax system that it was unrealistic to expect them to change their practices. Coming from him, that sounds rich. It's like, yeah, the tax system, you're a part of it. Like, what the hell? So this right here, it's really interesting to me. We always hear about the innovations, you know, that push progress forward for the better way of life for mankind. But it's hard to find the subtle little things here and there that kind of held progress back. This concept of an inability to change because of a culture basically being a people, being kept down, being forced into this paradigm that they can't escape. It's just kind of maddening to think about, especially if you live in a time where you know the potential for progress is there and you just kind of see it slip by and stagnate. So besides all of his other duties, Lavoisier had been a gunpowder commissioner since 1775. And his reputation for being highly organized is apparently what had landed him that role. And this was a result of having to oust the private company that was supplying gunpowder before to France. So they had, of course, they had one. It's a similar situation with the tax farms. They had outsourced the gunpowder monopoly. It was just a bunch of monopolies. Well, you're in charge of the gunpowder. You're in charge of the tobacco. You're in charge of taxes. Kind of a silly system from my perspective. But anyway, so naturally he and the other three commission appointees would fix these problems because he's a very smart person, and the quality and quantity of gunpowder for France would significantly improve. Doesn't it seem like he would have been a way better king than King Louis XVI? Although I wonder if he would have supported the American Revolution. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. It'd be interesting. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if he was king, but we'll never know. But it's just such a weird comparison. You know, the king is inept. He's an idiot making keys with his blacksmith. There's nothing wrong with making keys, but you're a king and your country is in dire need of some leadership and you're making keys. But anyway, as a commissioner, Lavoisier, he would have a house and laboratory granted to him as part of his commission. So him and his family lived in this house and laboratory as part of this gunpowder commission. So all this other stuff he was doing was just cream on top of the cake, you know, or cream of the crop, whatever. So now in 1791, so this is before the king and queen had been executed, kind of in those intervening years where the revolution is building up and tension is, you know, there's fighting going on and there's, you know, basically two different governments sort of fighting each other. And Lavoisier would begin working on the system of weight and measures, so creating the metric system. He was a big contributor to that. And this system of weights and measures was adopted by the National Convention that was held on August 1st of 1793. At that same convention, he was named as one of the 27 farm generals who were ordered to be detained. See, so this national assembly, the new government, had, you know, they're just, you know, being bureaucrats about this and just slowly like, well, take that guy and that guy and, oh yeah, take all of those guys. They gotta go, you know. And eventually, you know, they're working their way up. And then, you know, 1793 is also when they get the king and queen of France. And that's basically the show, folks, you know, end of the monarchy, right? But Lavoisier would go into hiding for several months until he'd finally turn himself in at Port Royal for questioning in November of that same year. He tried to make a case for himself that he hadn't been involved in the Farm General Commission for years, but they weren't buying it. They didn't care. He was removed from the commission on weights and measures, and he had already been stripped of his post at the Gunpowder Commission the previous year, actually. His last major work was a proposal to the National Convention for the reform of French education. And it's too bad. They had to see that he was an asset to the nation, right? But he was part of this rotten core of the country. And they saw that he needed to be cut out, just like the rest of the leadership. So he faced 9 accusations of defrauding the state of money owed to it. And he was also accused of his work with tobacco for adding water to it before selling it. That whole thing came back to him. Yes, it made the tobacco heavier and they got more money for it, but also made the tobacco of a much higher quality. And that was his defense. The tobacco defense. Try and save your life by saying, I made tobacco better, though. But the court, they had other ideas. Apparently, they thought they could seize a bunch of assets from the Farm General and recover huge sums of money for the state. I mean, they had to pay debts. They had foreign debts. They are trying to fix the country. So it was about money as much as anything else. And apparently, an appeal was struck down. And legend has it that the judge said, the Republic needs neither scholars nor chemists. The course of justice cannot be delayed. Yuck. That sounds very much like Pol Pot attacking people with glasses or the Chinese Communist Party arresting professors. Very much feels like an overreaction, and it was. This was the terror, after all. This is the midst of the terror that I mentioned. Basically, it was a time when everyone who was remotely suspected of counter-revolutionary activities was rounded up, imprisoned, and killed. It's estimated that the revolutionary government, led by a fellow by the name of Robespierre, killed 30,000 to 50,000 people during a 10-month period. And yes, if you haven't guessed by now, Lavoisier was executed by guillotine. This happened on May 8, 1794. And before we go on, I just want to note how chaotic it was during this time. A few months later, that very judge who condemned Lavoisier would himself be executed when the people rose up against Robespierre, who was completely out of his mind, arresting all manner of people without any kind of due process. It was just madness. Robespierre would himself be executed as a result of this reaction, and things would become somewhat moderate. And this time was known as like Thermidorian reaction. So you had the revolution, and then the crazy terror, and then this Thermidorian reaction. It's kind of like, whoa, 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 settle down. We just, you know, we can't go crazy here. But we're not covering the terror. We're not covering the Thermidorian reaction. I'm going to keep that in mind, maybe for a newsletter topic sometime. But instead, we're going to move on to the Enlightenment and take a more broad look at how Enlightenment thinking changed the world. So what started the Enlightenment? Okay, so you could basically stick a pin anywhere in history before the Enlightenment and make a line of cause and effect, and you could probably get there. But I'm going to start something. I want to start by talking about something I thought was pretty interesting. And it was in the fall of Constantinople, of all places, way back. I mean, it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. It's no one's business but the Turks. But anyway, this happened way back in 1453 when it was still Constantinople. But Byzantine scholars fled Constantinople in 1453, and they managed to take Greek manuscripts with them to Italy. This would spark a renewed interest in older Greek ideas and culture. And then, of course, less than 50 years later, the printing press arrives, and all these philosophical ideas would be able to spread, because now you can print them. The thinking was that by studying ancient Greek and Roman texts, that it could improve education and moral philosophy. And the people who thought this were these Renaissance humanists. To be fair, the Renaissance started in the 1300s, though, and those manuscripts only arrived in 1453. So the Renaissance wasn't just about those Byzantine scholars. They were more or less adding fuel to the flames of progress that were already burning. What's fascinating is that the original flame that would start the Renaissance, that led to the Enlightenment, was lit by a single guy that I don't think a lot of people know about. Maybe, you know, if you're into history or paid attention to history class, maybe you know who he is, but I don't remember who he was. Francesco Petrarch was an Italian scholar born in 1304 AD. He is often credited with initiating the Renaissance through his rediscovery of classical texts and his development of humanism. Humanism, it's the intellectual movement he started that emphasized human potential and achievements rather than a constant emphasis on religious doctrine. So he kind of broke everyone out of this medieval trance that they were in. So to make an overgeneralization about the way things were in medieval Europe, the thinking of many in the Middle Ages and medieval Middle Ages, whatever you want to say, was that you lived for God. You labored for God so that you could get into heaven, and that's what's supposed to motivate you. And that's what kept order. And there's a reason that kings and nobility were always mixing, bumping elbows with clergymen. They, knowingly or not, are playing a game of control. And this philosophy was on a winning streak, this idea of control through religion, until this guy came along and lit this fire of human potential. And of the classical texts Petrarch rediscovered, the major one would be Cicero's letters. And Cicero was this outspoken, prominent Roman statesman. He was a lawyer, an orator, a philosopher, and a writer, of course. Otherwise, we wouldn't know who the hell Cicero was. And Cicero actually introduced many Romans to Greek philosophy. So there's this torch that was carried from the Greeks, being the likes of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and Cicero, and hands down those ideas. And then Petrarch finds Cicero's work, and he, in turn, spreads those ideas as well. That's often cited as being what kicked off the Renaissance. There are other thinkers that I could also mention here, such as Erasmus and Voltaire, but the Enlightenment and the Renaissance are going to come up so many more times on the show. I'll definitely work more on their ideas at some point, but they're really not going to be a part of this episode. I just don't have time. But what am I talking about with the Renaissance anyway? Well, what does this have to do with the Enlightenment? Well, the Renaissance, it created the conditions for the Enlightenment to happen. And humanism is a big part of this. Instead of people just sitting around having faith and, you know, trying to get into heaven and please God and all that, they started to believe in their own potential. Imagine a whole civilization that had been beaten down and had no hope other than to just hand over all their faith to God. There were endless wars, plagues, tyrannical rulers. What does God will? What does God will? Move on. You know, what hope would you have? You would just slave away, and then these new ideas show up. And so far, I'm kind of overlooking another big part of this, another angle here, the economic angle. Italy and Florence in particular were becoming very wealthy through the vast trade network that spanned across the Mediterranean and elsewhere. So wealth creates this class of people who have time on their hands, time to think about their own potential. And that's where you hear about the patronage of artists and scholars and support for humanist ideas and endeavors in the history books that, you know, just kind of, they'll paint a single stroke over the entire Renaissance. And that's kind of where the summary, right, is you hear about patronage and the arts, and you never really get into, well, why were they into all that? Well, because they could be. And then in the middle of the Renaissance, of course, there was Martin Luther, who challenged the Catholic Church, which, you know, that fractures the religious ideas, and this Protestant movement would grow, weakening and creating more room for more ideas to grow, more Enlightenment ideas. Again, the humanists were always there all along, getting louder and louder. And I don't want to paint the wrong picture here. They didn't call themselves humanists. It's not like they were part of this some united movement, you know, where they're all marching in the streets together. That's more of a label that would come from Jacob Burckhardt in the 19th century. And he was defining the overall cultural shift that was happening. It's just a way of kind of labeling the direction, the trajectory that the mindset was headed. So this revival in believing in human potential naturally leads to greater interest in grammar, rhetoric, poetry, history, and of course, philosophy. So this proto-Enlightenment time in the Renaissance reinvigorates interest in study overall. So what comes when you study hard? Well, new ideas. And from these new ideas, the scientific revolution. Look at Lavoisier. He was only able to work so hard on scientific study because he had the time to do it, and the inclination built up over the previous centuries by other researchers and thinkers. And he wasn't alone. There were philosophical thinkers that came before him, of course. John Locke is one of these philosophical thinkers. The way he defined the way that we define the beginning of the Renaissance as being started by Francesco Petrarch, many argue that John Locke definitively locked us in to the Enlightenment period. This is interesting to me because here are the cliff notes on Locke. So shout out to Jeffrey Kaplan on YouTube for the wisdom on John Locke. I really like his YouTube videos. It's all philosophy stuff and it's all demonetized, so you can watch it all for free. He's got a really good way of speaking, breaking things down. So he said that Locke would basically state that there are moral rules governing all humans. This is really clever of Locke. He'd say that everyone is equal and independent. No one ought to harm another in their life, liberty, or possessions. Yeah, you can guess where the Declaration of Independence got some of their lines from. So Locke is basically declaring that morally, man should not kill, should not hurt another, should not enslave another, but then also that you could not steal from another. Okay? And he makes this argument in a really good way. He says, look, if God created man and created man to be his servant on earth, then we are all his possessions. Okay? So we are all God's possessions. Therefore, to harm anyone would be to harm God's possessions. So now the people of Locke's day could have looked at this work and probably many of them completely reasoned from his work alone that these notions of independence, and they embraced, they could say, well, even God wants us to be enlightened. Even God, you know, they basically turned religion against itself in a way. I don't know if you say against itself, but they redirected religion in a way by saying we all need to be treat each other as equals because God created us and we're all his possessions. So it's kind of a logical argument that you kind of just go, yeah, okay. So personally, I think there was a large set of people who are already looking for an argument like this one that Locke is making, and then they could just point to that argument and go, yeah, that's why we believe what we believe. This guy, he said it the best. So it's just an argument to justify their wants to be free, independent, and equal. And I think that they're pointing to this after the fact because they kind of selectively took what Locke said. I mean, take slavery as an example. Locke came up with the divine morality in 1689. Slavery didn't really start being abolished for at least 150 more years. But nevertheless, John Locke and tying things to religion to sell them, it's not uncommon. In fact, that's how Christianity did it in the first place. You loop in some ideas from the old religion that other people are used to and combine it with the new ideas and shazam. Same thing. You know, Christianity is now being the tool to advance humanism rather than the old gods and the old pagan beliefs being roped in to advance Christianity. So the turntables kind of turned on Christianity in that way. And all this humanism, again, is still somewhat grounded in economics. You know, technology allows for more and more people to spend less time doing labor and more time thinking. But it's, remember, it's selective. Some people are still doing a great deal of labor. And, you know, they are thinking about ways to improve technology. And then we have progress, you know, and, you know, this continues and continues. And then some 350 years later, and here I am sitting in my air-conditioned house with all kinds of devices that make my life easier to reduce labor and allow me to spend more of my time thinking and doing what I want. I should be reminding myself in the mirror every morning that I'm a privileged person over and over again. But that would be squandering all the hard work, all the labor that others did so that I could be here sitting down and giving this podcast. So, talking about technology, what goes hand in hand with that is the scientific revolution, right? Humanism wins again. And the scientific revolution, of course, is considered to start with Nicholas Copernicus when he wrote De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium on the revolutions of the celestial spheres. And really, that scientific revolution, that scientific progress, it's never really stopped. Did you know that 90% of scientists from 1900 onward were alive in 2012? That means that there are more scientists now than there were ever before. So if you ever get depressed about the many problems in our world, just keep in mind that there is still some progress being made amidst all this chaos we call modern times. But now, let's talk about one of these enlightened scientists and his influence on electricity, Alessandro Volta. London, 1782. The humanism and belief in human potential was thriving amongst four men. These four men met to discuss a topic that was very interesting to all of them, electricity. These men included William Nicholson, Tiberius Cavallo, Abraham Bennett, and Alessandro Volta. They would all be great influences on each other, and all would contribute to the advancement of science, especially in the area of electricity. This type of collaboration and meeting was common during the Enlightenment. Ideas would just build off of each other. But what were they discussing? Well, here's what everyone knew about electricity at the time. You know, what did, you know, just to give an idea of what they knew up to that point. Static electricity had been known for a long time, being easy to generate through friction. The concept of positive and negative charges had been established thanks to Ben Franklin's work in the 1740s. And you might have thought this episode was going to veer towards old Franklin with his reputation for being a scientist who studied electricity and also being an important diplomat and getting French support for the American Revolution. I kind of wonder why I didn't talk about him more, but I'll think about that later. Well, I could have, but I'm going to save him for another episode. You know, maybe something to do with the American Revolution or something, but anyway, so we understood static electricity, positive and negative charges. What else? Well, the principle of conservation of charge was also understood. The principle states that electric charge can neither be created nor destroyed. So just like the conservation of mass that Lavoisier devised, it was just applied again towards electricity. And the total amount of charge in an isolated system never changes. That's what this law states. Charges may be transferred from one object to another, but the net charge always remains the same. So it's just like the conservation of energy, conservation of matter, but it was the conservation of electric charge at the time. And this principle was understood thanks to William Watson, a member of that meeting in London in 1782. He had first proposed the principle in 1746. However, by 1782, this principle hadn't been definitively proven yet, and there was much more to learn about the nature of electricity. Unfortunately, exactly what they talked about in this meeting isn't known. But Volta had recently invented the electrophorus in 1775, a device used to generate static electricity. He was also actively working on other inventions. They probably exchanged notes on this and other ideas they were having. I mean, at the time, there were still many competing theories on the nature of electricity. Volta was a proponent of Franklin's single fluid theory. Abraham Bennett also had an ongoing work in this theory, and he likely brought up some ideas relating to what would be his most famous invention. It would come 5 years later, which is the gold leaf electroscope. This was an early scientific instrument used to detect and measure electrical charges. So a lot of these guys are just making these inventions that help them understand electricity even more. They're not exactly definitively figuring out things. They're like, well, what if we do this? And what if you do that? So Tiberius Cavallo, to round off the group, like Volta, he was an Italian. Though Volta was only visiting London, Cavallo had moved to London the previous year. It seems likely that Cavallo would have been instrumental in organizing the meeting, you know, to coincide with Volta's visit to London. Cavallo had thoroughly studied electricity, and he had written a complete treatise on electricity in 1777, which became the standard text on the subject at the time. He was actually quite a prolific writer of science, having authored several works by 1782. And all four men, like I say, they would greatly contribute to science. Volta's contribution would be very significant and would stand out among the four. So let's roll back now and walk through Volta's life and career and unpack his work. So he was born in Como, Italy in 1745. His father, Filippo Volta, was from a noble family. So he was kind of born into a bit of a privileged life, much like Lavoisier. And the Volta family belonged to the Lombard aristocracy and had close ties with ecclesiastic circles. In fact, his father, Filippo, had been a member of the Society of Jesus for 11 years. So there was a lot of religion in his early household, to say the least. Apparently, he didn't start to speak, though, until he was 4 years old. His family actually kind of thought he was a bit dim and slow, although they used a different word in the reading that I read, but I'm not going to say that. His father died, actually, when Alessandro was only 7 years old, and this would be kind of a turning point for the young boy. Under his uncle's tutelage, he would begin to catch up with the kids around him in his education. In 1758, when he was about 13 years old, he'd be enrolled in the Jesuit School of Rhetoric. In his teen years, Volta would learn Latin, English, and French. So, you know, he goes from being 4 years old, and now he's a teenager, and he's natively speaking Italian and manages to learn three other languages. His potential is going to be recognized, and it is. One of the priests tried to get Volta to follow the priesthood, and Volta's uncle would try to persuade him into a career in law. Neither of these disciplines satisfied Volta. From a young age, he had already made up his mind to be a physicist. So by the age of 18, Volta would already be very active and outgoing. He would correspond with authorities on electricity and exchange ideas with them, and he was already putting his own ideas forward on the matter of electricity. And this was without any university training. He just perused this field relentlessly. In 1764, he got a chance to use the physics lab of Giulio Cesare Gattoni. Gattoni was a friend, and he was a huge influence on Volta's early interest in electricity. And in 1769, Volta would put out his first dissertation, On the Forces of Attraction of Electric Fire. In this work, he wrote out his ideas on the causes of electrical attraction and repulsion. He would compare these electrical forces with gravity. He argued that similar to gravity, static electricity involved an action at a distance. He'd done some research, some very serious research, really. His paper would reference Isaac Newton and Benjamin Franklin, as well as others who had made recent breakthroughs or contributions to physics and science in general. That Enlightenment just, you know, all these people are exchanging ideas together. You know, none of this would have happened without the printing press, of course. I keep bringing up the printing press over and over and over again. The printing press. But how could they exchange all these ideas if they weren't able to read about each other's ideas? Certainly the printing press was huge influence in the Enlightenment. But anyway, moving on. This paper would make its way to prominent Italian scientists at the time, and Volta's career began to advance. In 1774, he was appointed superintendent and regent of the Royal Schools of Como. And just a quick note here, he's about 24 years old, and he's able to do this research because he's from a family of wealthy people, like many of his contemporaries. And that class of people from the Renaissance would gain wealth and establish this class of people who didn't have to labor all day and night because they had all this established wealth. It's important to keep in mind that all these enlightened ideas would not have mattered or really come about if there wasn't a class of people with the time on their hands to pursue these things. And that's the real crux of the show today. With while others' lot in life or fate, whatever you want to say, would define them in a life where they labor was the only path, others born into privilege would look at the world and actually try to improve it because they could. And the only reason they could was on the backs of all these laborers. Sure, technology would have made some work easier and more efficient progress, but there was still this class of people that all these wealthy scientists depended on. Almost all the scientists and big thinkers of this time are privileged people. But I think a reason they should still be celebrated is because, despite their privilege, they didn't squander their lives. Think about Louis XV, Louis XVI, or maybe even Marie Antoinette. What benefit to society were they, at large? They just squandered their wealth and lived these shallow, meaningless lives despite their high positions of authority. There was a mountain of labor and hardship that contributed to nothing, to no human progress, because of these unenlightened people squandered their time. So in 1775, then Volta invents this electrophorus. Actually, he only improved and popularized the electrophorus. This happens all the time. I don't know how many times I've said this on the show where it's like, oh, well, he invented it is what I hear at one place. And that's like, actually, he didn't invent it. He popularized it. But in any case, thereafter, he would begin studying chemistry of gases after he'd done, you know, he's just jumping around, doing whatever, I guess. So, but Volta would again be influenced by Benjamin Franklin when he learned of Franklin's paper on flammable air. And this would lead to Volta discovering methane. And he even isolated it in 1778. So no big deal. Just while he's busy doing all this electrical work, discovery and work, he just kind of happenstance just invent methane. He discovered methane. And so Volta was also studying electrical capacitance at this time. And this would lead to Volta's law of capacitance. The law states that electrical potential difference and charge are proportional for a given object. For this work, the unit of electrical potential is named after him, the volt, obviously. Though Volta would never know this honor, it wasn't given the name volt until 1881 by the International Electric Congress in Paris, which sounds like a pretty cool band name, by the way, International Electric Congress. But anyway, in 1779, he became a professor of experimental physics at the University of Pavia in Italy. He would actually hold this chair for over 40 years. And Volta would be a famously remembered scientist alone for his work that he's done so far that I've mentioned, but he was far from done. Volta would become an extremely popular lecturer. I had no idea he was this popular. He's amazingly popular. His classes became so popular at the school that they had to make a larger theater just for him to be able to give his lectures. He had so many students that wanted to hear his lectures. So Volta would continue to study electricity while being a professor and lecturer. And what would become his greatest invention came about in kind of an odd way. In the 1780s, there were some experiments done by Luigi Galvani on frog legs. And he observed muscle contractions when frog legs were touched with different metals. He proposed the existence of animal electricity intrinsic to living tissue. Okay, so Volta disagreed with this concept of animal electricity and argued electricity was generated by contact between different metals. He claimed that the animal's tissue merely conducted the electricity, not generated it. Volta extensively studied Galvani's theory, with various animals and was able to induce muscle contractions. It really gives me kind of Mary Shelley Frankenstein vibes here, and it got me wondering. And indeed, Mary Shelley said herself, boy, that she was influenced by real experiments and discussions about galvanism. And yeah, that galvanic response is named after Luigi Galvani. So Mary Shelley would have been likely have been influenced by Volta, and certainly was influenced by Galvani when writing Frankenstein. So that's kind of cool. So galvanism was actually a term coined by Volta himself, which giving respect to Galvani and his work. So even though they disagreed, there's some enlightened ideas right there. You know, these guys are disagreeing on things, and yet they're building off each other, and hey, we'll name that after you. How about that? Anyway, this research would lead Volta in a direction towards an understanding of the electrochemical series. And it's basically the electrochemical series is kind of a way that electricity is transferred between different metals. I'd love to have gone into it a little bit more but I just don't have enough time here. Maybe again, might be an article that I'll write on Substack. So his understanding of this electrochemical series, it would lead to his most important invention. And he finds time during this time, though. Because during this time, Volta finds time to marry. He marries Teresa Peregrini, a fellow aristocrat from Como, and together they would raise three boys. And Volta was apparently quite a family man. I was so used to reading about these, you know, geniuses, and they're always the worst people when it comes to family. But I was so delighted that it sounds like he was a decent family man. Especially as he got older, it sounds like he was more private and just spent time with his family. So anyway, back to his most important invention. In the year 1800, Volta invented the electric pile, which was the first true electric battery. The battery was actually fairly simple. It was layers of pairs of copper and zinc discs stacked on top of one another, with each pair separated by a layer of cloth or cardboard soaked in brine. And this would provide scientists with a tool that could be used to provide a steady electrical current. And Volta was highly lauded for this invention of the electric pile. It was immediately recognized as a scientific breakthrough. It was such a well-known achievement that Volta was even invited by none other than Napoleon Bonaparte, who was now the first consul of France. How the hell did that happen? Well, in the meantime, while we were talking about the Enlightenment and Volta, Napoleon basically took over the government in a military coup in France in 1799, and he was about to wage war all over Europe in the name of free trade. So that's that, but that's another story, you know. I'll talk about Napoleon some other time. I really like talking about Napoleon. I read a very long book about him and I'm very interested in him, but we just don't have time to even scratch the surface. So Bonaparte made Volta a count and senator of the kingdom of Lombardy as a result of his achievements. So that's nice for Volta, I guess. Volta continued to refine and improve his electric pile invention, developing variants of the original battery. But then Volta also, he continued as a professor. He would be named director of the philosophical faculty at the University of Pavia in 1815. And then by 1819, Volta was ready to retire. And he spent the remaining years close to home, you know, just privately. He seems like a real family man. And then he died in 1827 after spending several years suffering from various illnesses. I gotta say, out of all the characters I've researched since starting this Meridians project, Volta seems like he just won the game of life. I'm sure, I know I just said that he died after spending years suffering from various illnesses, but he lived a fairly long life, and he pursued exactly what he wanted in life. He was massively successful as an inventor, and he was massively successful as a professor, and to me, he seems like he was a good father. I mean, he brought his kids into his lab and kind of taught them what he could. He seemed like a decent dad for back then, how many dads do you hear about back in, you know, all these historical figures, you know, oh yeah, he was a scientist and his wife hated him and you know, there's so many of them like that. But this thing about progress, though, that I've been talking about all day, it kind of, this idea of individual credit, it just doesn't quite sit right with me. Like, why do we give any individual credit? I mean, it's just kind of in our nature, I guess, but in history, like, most notable people, to a man, every single one of them relied on some large network or group of people in their society for their achievements. And I say man on purpose because very few women got the credit they deserved for being the spouse or maybe coming up with the ideas as well. We'll never know how many ideas were bounced off their spouses, and certainly they contributed. Like I said, Lavoisier's wife helped him in the lab. I'm sure that Volta's wife was there to support him, to bounce ideas off of. And, you know, it's not even a gender thing. It's not just about that. I'm really talking about the entire society around these people and the achievements that made them possible. Volta wasn't toiling on a farm. He wasn't laboring at the docks, mining, shipping goods, sewing, smithing, or anything that enabled his lifestyle. He relied on everyone around him. I mean, I guess that's society, but at least in a free world, there's the choice. There's always the opportunity. Back in this time when most of these people lived, there wasn't this free movement of anything. And that's what's so important about this idea of enlightenment and liberty, that we kind of, looking back, it's like, yeah, liberty, that's a good thing. But when you don't really look at it from that perspective of the laborer that didn't, they didn't have a choice. You didn't just, oh, well, he's really smart, so he's not going to be a laborer. No, that's not how it worked. You were just a smart laborer. You're not going to get into some university. You're poor. They're not going to recognize it. There's just maybe a very, very few cases. I think Michael Faraday would be one of them, but that came later in the 1800s. I think he was kind of poor, but I can't think of anybody. I'm sure there'll be somebody say, well, actually, there's dozens and dozens of people. But from where I'm sitting, it seems like a lot of the scientific progress, a lot of these enlightened thinkers were also privileged people. And there's also a good book. I got done with this research, and then I remembered thinking about this book, and I just wanted to include it here. And it's a lot about the Enlightenment and progress. And there are so many different ways to look at how the Enlightenment came about. You know, I just tackled one, you know, I tackled part of it, but, you know, I didn't even mention other people like Voltaire or Erasmus. There's this book by Stephen Greenblatt called The Swerve, and How the World Became Modern. And it was basically about this discovery of this very specific poem, and the poem is basically defying religion way before John Locke ever comes around. And the book is called The Swerve, but I highly recommend it. It's really good. I think I need to revisit it now because it's been years and years. But anyway, let's now go on to the top 10 of the episode. The top 10. All right. I am restructuring from my original character summary / character review, which I could never seem to remember which way I named it. So now I'm calling this section the top 10 of the episode. Boy, should I just say the top 10? Let's just call it the top 10. And we're just going to focus on the top 10 most important people, places, or things from the episode. So I'm not going to do before like I used to. I used to just basically mention anybody that had their name in the episode. It's like, this is kind of silly to mention people that barely had anything to do with the episode. So I'm just, the top 10 person, places, or things about the episode, and, you know, maybe I'll be able to expand on some of the things, you know, maybe I missed this detail about this guy or whatever. But so here we go. And today, for funsies, I'm going to say whether this person, place, or thing was progressive or regressive, just for fun. So King Louis XV, a philandering king who didn't seem to serve France in any meaningful way, regressive. King Louis XVI, inept as his grandfather, yet he managed to trip over some hypothetical fine china in his decadence and influence two great democratic revolutions. So whether he likes it or not, for his incompetence, amazing enough, progressive. Marie Antoinette, I almost want to abstain from rating her. She led a complicated life, and I don't want to give her a pass. I still don't want to give her a pass. Well, because she's a woman, you know, that wouldn't be right. I feel like she should be judged the same way as her husband. But since she did stand with her husband, even when she knew her life was hanging in the balance, progressive, I guess. I feel bad for her for losing her three kids. There's a big bleeding heart I am. But anyway, Antoine Lavoisier. Despite his activities in the Farm General, I have to say that his scientific achievement overshadows easily any part of his life that would be considered regressive. So Lavoisier is progressive. However, the Farm General, tax collecting chumps, regressive. No more need to be said about them. Paris, France in general, they overcame their decadent, tyrannical leaders and forged a new path to France. For France, not to France, they were in France. So how can they be anything but progressive? The Bastille, this represented regression in the old ways of France and of the feudal world, really, at large. The destruction of the Bastille is a reflection of progress itself. So of course, the Bastille is regressive. Okay, John Locke, obviously a powerful force in the Enlightenment. So, as a confusing and troubling character, he's also the confusing and troubling character from the TV show Lost, but anyway, he's still progressive. Likewise, Francesco Petrarch created the humanist movement. He changed the mindset of the people, and he set the Renaissance on its course. Progressive, of course he's progressive. And then Alessandro Volta, an admirable scientist and a dedicated family man. He lived a profound life, and he made every bit of his privilege count, even though he, like so many others, was able to make all of his scientific progress on the backs of a bunch of laborers. He's progressive. He did everything right with his life, as far as I could tell. Thank you so much for listening to Meridians. I really appreciate it. If you have any feedback on the episode, please do email me at feedback@meridianspodcast.com. And if you want to read some companion articles I've written for the show, check out my Substack over at meridianspodcast.substack.com. Or you can just find everything at meridianspodcast.com. I'm Charlie Noble, and thanks for listening.